I don't know how well you know your Bible, but there's one book in the Bible which contains the favourite verse of the following. Mrs. Thatcher, church congregations during the sermon, and students. Mrs. Thatcher's favourite verse is as follows. A wise person's heart inclines towards the right. But a fool's heart toward the left. You, as congregations now listening to a congregation now listening to a sermon, this is your favourite verse, if you didn't know it. The more the words, the less the meaning. And how does that profit anyone? Now, some of you students may know this one, which is your favourite verse. New books are always being published. And much study, Nigel, is a weariness to the body. And, of course, open before us is the book of Ecclesiastes, which we're going to be looking at today and next week. And the way we've just approached it illustrates exactly the problem that most of us have with this book, if we're familiar with it at all, which is that it's very easy to reduce it to the level of an American presidential election, by which I mean that we simply see it as a matter of finding a few good one-liners and then leaving the rest. No, there's more to Ecclesiastes than that. Well, you say, Ecclesiastes, I don't actually know who he is or what the book's about at all. Let's try and ask those questions then. Who is the writer and what is the nature of this book open in front of us? Well, the writer tells us who he is in verse 1 of chapter 1, the words of the preacher, the son of David, king of Jerusalem, repeated again in verse 12 of chapter 1. Now, who is this preacher, this son of David, who's a king? He may have been Solomon. And if he wasn't Solomon, then he certainly seems to have tracked Solomon's experience very closely and to have followed in the wisdom tradition of which Solomon was a major exponent in his day. Some, like the RSV, if you have it open, call him the preacher, or Good News Bible, the philosopher. Or some even the professor, which I rather like. Now, what about the nature of his book? Well, have a look at verse 13 of chapter 1. I, the philosopher, the preacher, the professor, applied my mind to seek and to search out by wisdom all that is done under heaven. In other words, the nature of the book is that it is an investigative report, a comprehensive survey of life as we know it. No holds barred, everything under the microscope. No government committee has set terms of reference to limit the scope of the report or to soften its impact. And unlike most of our reports, the conclusion is given right at the beginning so that we know exactly where the report has led. Verse 2, vanity of vanities, says the preacher. All is vanity. Or in a more modern translation, meaningless, meaningless, utterly meaningless. Everything is meaningless. And a chasing after wind. Verse 14, all is vanity and a striving after wind or a chasing after wind. Trying to find meaning in life, says the writer, is like trying to catch the wind. I don't know how many of you would be willing to have a go after the service outside. Any volunteers to help me try and catch the wind? I see no hands. Well, you say it's such a stupid thing to suggest, isn't it? There's no point to it. You can't catch the wind. You can't get a handle on the wind. Exactly, says the professor. Nor can you find sense in life. There's no meaning in life. It doesn't make sense. You can't catch hold of it. It's like one of those infuriating puzzles that some people leave lying about in their living rooms. You know the sort of thing I mean? The ones that particularly infuriate me are the wooden ones. I know if I take it apart, I'll never get it back together again. I just cannot make sense of it. Now, it's interesting that in the history of thinking in the world, this professor is not the first or the last to conclude that life has no meaning. Albert Camus, he got very much to the same kind of thing. If you ever want a quote on meaninglessness, Albert Camus is the place to go. "I proclaim," he writes, "that I believe in nothing and that everything is absurd." Everything is absurd. So he doubts even his own existence. But hold on a minute, you say, we're in a church. We're reading the Bible. Is this really true? Are you really saying that life has no meaning? Does the professor of Ecclesiastes really say that? And if he does say that, then why on earth has his book been included in the Bible? Surely it contradicts the message of the Bible. Doesn't the Bible say, don't you Christians say that life has got meaning? Well, is it true that life has no meaning? Well, this is where we have to come to the one crucial limitation to the scope of the professor's report. He's quite open about it, but we need to take note of it if we're going to understand this book aright. Look at verse 14. Verse 13, where we looked at his terms of reference. "I applied my mind," verse 13, "to seek and to search out by wisdom all that is done," where? "Under heaven." And so verse 14, "I have seen everything that is done," where? "Under the sun." Now, that's not just a throwaway phrase, "under the sun." It comes about 30 times in these 12 chapters. Good News Bible translates, "in this world." It's a phrase by which the writer is saying that he is looking at this world purely in its own terms, without reference to God. Oh, there may be a God who wound up the universe at the beginning to get it going, but he's not the great interferer who sustains and keeps going the world, or the supreme judge who will one day come back to this world. No, we're just looking at life under the sun, in this world. Well, you say, if that is the case, then why is this book in the Bible? It's not surprising that someone's referred to it as the Joker in the pack. Well, the answer, I would suggest, is this. The professor is saying, by implication, okay, let's look at what life is really like, lived as a practical atheist. In other words, without reference at all to God. Let's step into the shoes of that person, and let's see what life adds up to. So you see, the purpose of Ecclesiastes is as a challenge to the secularist. Now, if you wouldn't know a secularist if you fell over one in the park, by secularist, I mean someone who lives their life without reference to God. I heard recently of a girl called Jenny who became a Christian a few years ago, and shortly after becoming a Christian, she read this book, the whole of Ecclesiastes, for the first time in her life. And a comment at the end of that was very interesting. She said, "That's exactly how life was before I became a Christian." She'd understood it. It's life lived without reference to God. And the challenge comes in this way. The professor gives us a guided tour of the godless life. He pulls no punches in describing what he observes of life as it really is without God. He invites us up on the tour bus and says, "Come and have a look round at what life is like without God. Do you really want this?" There are so many tourist buses, aren't there, around the place, especially in this part of London. most days of the week I cross over London Bridge on my bicycle, and I'm forever nearly running into the back of those tourist buses that stop to look first of all at the monument and then at Tower Bridge halfway across London Bridge. I don't know how many places they stop at, but I do know that tonight we only have time for the shortened version of the professor's guided tour of A Godless Life. And we're going to stop off at four of the low points that he takes the tour on. The first is pleasure, second, money, the third, do-goodery, the philosophy of doing good, and the fourth is death, just to keep you really excited at the end. Now, we don't have to go very far for the first stop on this tour. So fasten your seatbelts and come to chapter 2, where we're going to look at pleasure. I said to myself, said the professor, come now, I will make a test of pleasure. Enjoy yourself. But behold, this also was pointless. I said of laughter, it is mad. And of pleasure, what use is it? I searched with my mind how to cheer my body with wine, my mind still guiding me with wisdom, and how to lay hold on folly, till I might see what was good for the sons of men to do under heaven during the few days of their life. Well, he was going to give pleasure for the body. He tried wine. He was going to give pleasure for the mind. He tried laughter. But what use are they? His conclusion, verse 2, is that laughter, it's madness. And other pleasure, where does it lead to? What is the point of it? Now, you may have come up to London this autumn, maybe for the first time, to college, away from home. And the old restraints of home and family have gone. You can do what you like. You can drink as much as you like. You can try some drugs or different drugs. You could try sex or more sex. Try pleasure. Where will it lead you? They will enslave you, unless you're very careful. More than that, they will destroy you if you let them. You don't have to walk very far on the streets of London, provided you have your eyes open, to see plenty of examples of people destroyed in this way. Okay, you say, I'll leave that kind of pleasure. I'll try laughter and madness. Well, where will laughter and madness take you? Wonder how many of you remember Tony Hancock. Hancock's Half Hour? Few of you admit to being old enough. Was watched by over 15 million people at a time in 1961. That was about 30% of the population. Remember the blood donor sketch? I won't do my impersonation of it. I'll spare you that. Tony Hancock, writes Derek Tidball in his commentary on Ecclesiastes, committed suicide in 1968. In his personal life, he had been deeply unhappy for years, always striving to understand himself, and yet never doing so. It was a tragic end to a brilliant life. His biographer writes, it may be that Hancock eventually managed to see himself in the cosmic perspective he had sought for years, as an insignificant speck of dust in an obscure corner of the universe, end product of a long line of accidental survivals. It is one thing to talk about the need for perspective. It must be unbearable to find it. Another writer aptly comments at this point, when you learn to laugh at everything, you are soon left with nothing worth the bother of a laugh. laughter. It's mad, says the professor. Now, if you go on through chapter 2, you see all kinds of other forms of pleasure that he tried, and we probably don't have the time or the money in our lives to try to gratify ourselves with pleasure, as the professor did. But let's look at his conclusion in verse 10. He says, "Whatever my eyes desired, I did not keep from them. I drew no boundaries. There were no limits. I did everything that pleased me. I kept my heart from no pleasure." Verse 11, "Then I considered all that my hands had done and the toil I had spent in doing it. And behold, all was vanity and a striving after wind, and there was nothing to be gained under the sun." What is the point of pleasure? Ultimately, it's pointless. Well, our tour bus goes on at this point, and we travel towards money. And we go over, you're already over the page, most of you, I know from the sound of the pages, cross on page 589, chapters 4 and 5. And as we reach this second low point of the tour, the guided tour of a godless life, we glance in two directions. First of all, we glance in the direction of incurable but purposeless workaholism. Chapter 4, verses 7 and 8. "Again, I saw something meaningless under the sun. A person who has no one, either son or brother, yet there is no end to all his toil, and his eyes are never satisfied with riches, so that he never asks, 'For whom am I toiling and depriving myself of pleasure?'" His Porsche is sitting at home in the garage. He's far too busy earning money to have time to drive it and enjoy it. But it never crosses his mind to say, "Well, why am I doing all this? Who's benefiting?" And then across to chapter 5, verse 10, where we see tantalizing dissatisfaction. "He who loves money will not be satisfied with money, nor he who loves wealth with gain. This also is meaningless." One of the Rockefeller family in the United States, when asked which million he'd enjoyed making the most, replied, "The next." Chuck Swindoll, an American writer, writes as follows on this point. "The itch for things, the lust for more, so brilliantly injected by those who peddle them, is a virus draining our souls of happy contentment. Have you noticed? A man never earns enough. A woman is never beautiful enough. Clothes are never fashionable enough. Cars are never nice enough. Gadgets are never modern enough. Houses are never furnished enough. Food is never fancy enough. Relationships are never romantic enough. Life is never full enough. And with money, especially so." Again, I wonder if there are some here who've just arrived in London. Let me ask you, are you going to allow yourself, if you've just started work, to be sucked into the rampant workaholism of London? That workaholism itself fueled by the desire for bigger profits, a fatter pay packet. If you set your heart on money, you'll never be satisfied. You can never get enough of it while you're alive, and you can't take any of it with you when you die. You may lose it all in the next market crash. If you don't, then you have to leave it to people who've never lifted a finger to earn it and may quickly squander it. So what's the point of money? Ultimately, it is pointless. Pleasure, money. Back on the bus and off to our third low point. Over the page. Chapter 8. Do-goodery. The philosophy of just living a good life. You may say this is all a bit negative, what we're looking at so far. Surely even if you look at life just under the sun, life in this world, then there is a point to living a good life and helping others, isn't there? Yes, says the professor, verse 12 of chapter 8. Though a sinner does evil 100 times and prolongs his life, yet I know that it will be well with those who fear God, because they fear before him. But it will not be well with the wicked. Neither will he prolong his days like a shadow, because he doesn't fear before God. Yes, there is point living a good life. But then again, no. That's not the full story, is it, verse 14? Because there is a vanity, a meaningless thing which takes place on earth. That there are righteous men to whom it happens according to the deeds of the wicked. And there are wicked men to whom it happens according to the deeds of the righteous. I said that this also is meaningless. And that's the same point made back in chapter 7, verse 15. In my vain life, I've seen everything. There is a righteous man who perishes in his righteousness, and there is a wicked man who prolongs his life in his evil doing. It's not as simple as saying, yes, it's worth living a good life and doing good and helping others. And so many people settle for the classic position of verses 16 to 18 of chapter 7. Don't be too righteous. Don't be too good. Don't make yourself too wise. Why destroy yourself? On the other hand, don't be too bad either. Don't be a fool. Why should you die before your time? It's good that you should take hold of this, probably righteousness, and from that, from wickedness, don't withhold your hand. It's all right to have a little of that too. For he who fears God shall come forth from them all. Moderation in all things. Isn't that what the Bible says somewhere, I thought? Yes, verse 16. Be good. Visit an elderly neighbor or two. Buy a meal for a dosser once or twice a month. Make out a small covenant for a charity of your choice. But don't overdo it. Don't bust the gut in being good. Then again, verse 17, don't think that living a decent life is too restrictive. I mean, you needn't worry about the occasional minor untruth to get you out of a sticky patch of trouble, nor a piece of well-planned and safe fornication or adultery, provided, of course, that you don't get caught by the steady partner or spouse in the act. I mean, don't be that bad. Why die before your time? You see, verse 18, it's good to be broad-minded and have a little of that and a little of the other. Be good, but not too good, and don't worry about keeping bad out of your life. Got to be broad-minded. And of course, provided that you doff your cap to God now and then and turn up to church occasionally, he'll see you right in the end. And so, graphically, the professor traces the fundamental compromise of the person who is thinking only in terms of this world. But that's not really the professor's point of view. He knows more than that. You can see that from his conclusion at the end of chapter 7, verse 29. Behold, this alone I found, that God made man upright. But they, that's mankind, have sought out many schemes and devices. It's not God's fault that man's like that, but man is like that. Verse 20 of chapter 7, surely there is not a righteous man on earth who does good and never sins. Now, God isn't fooled by our little pretenses, our compromises. He's not fobbed off with our do-goodery. He doesn't pull the wool over God's eyes. And now our final low point. So back on the bus again. And off to the lowest point of them all, perhaps. The point of death. It's the ultimate statistic, isn't it? One in one die. I had this very happily worded advert through the post from the National Westminster Bank not so long ago. I think it was advertising life insurance, which I always call death insurance, but that's the point of argument. Its final sentence, to try and get you to reach for your checkbook, was, just consider, however, that within less than an hour, someone in the UK will be killed as the result of an accident. By the time the day is over, accidents will have claimed the lives of over 40 people. Well, that's a happy thought to make you sign a check, isn't it? But they have a point. They'd agree with the professor in chapter 8, verse 8. No man has power to retain the spirit or authority over the day of death. No one has the power to determine the day on which they're going to die. God alone determines that. There was young David a week ago yesterday. Got up, had breakfast, drove down to the ground, warmed up with the boys, went out onto the pitch, the big cheer as ever, played his game, great run down the right wing, crosses the ball over to the centre, and drops dead. David Longhurst, age 25, York City footballer, as was. Chapter 9, verse 1. But all this I laid to heart, examining it all, how the righteous and the wise and their deeds are in the hand of God. Now, what's God going to do with all these people? Whether it is love or hate, man doesn't know. We don't really know God if we just live on this earth under the sun. We don't know how he's going to handle us if we fall into his hand. Everything before them is pointless, since one fate comes to all, to the righteous and the wicked, to the good and the evil, to the clean and the unclean, to him who comes to church and to him who never bothers. As is the good man, so is the sinner, and he who swears is one who never bothers. This is an evil in all that is done under the sun, that one fate comes to all. Verse 4, he who is joined with all the living has hope, for a living dog, or we might say a rat that's alive, is better than a lion that's dead. They all go to the same place, don't they? Go down the crematorium in South Norwood. You'll see the times posted outside. 10:15, a name, might be a millionaire. 10:45, another name, might be a pauper. But you know, as they go through into the flames, they have the same amount of money in their pocket now. 11:15, another name, might be a gangland godfather. 11:45, a fourth name, could have been a church warden. Now, doubtless, they were all praised at their funeral. It's difficult to be totally honest then, isn't it? But if there is nothing beyond this life, then all that remains of them is a memory, which gradually fades as those who remembered them become themselves only memories in the minds of others. You see, the writer is saying that since the same fate overtakes everybody, whether you're good or bad, then it really doesn't matter how you live, does it? It's immaterial if death levels us all to the dust. So, ladies and gentlemen, we come to the end of our guided tour of A Godless Life, the short version, that is, and four of the low points. Pleasure, money, do-goodery, and death. Bye-bye. We say, is that all? I mean, are we just going to stop there? Is this guided tour of A Godless Life nothing more than a grueling mental trek through the desert, leaving us stranded and gasping for a drink at the end? Well, the answer, of course, is that when you have time for the full guided tour, you'll see that occasionally the professor takes the tour party off the bus and up a high sand dune and points across the desert to an oasis, which we're going to be looking at next week. But I couldn't bear to leave you in the middle of the desert just like that without giving a clue to those who won't be able to make it next week or who can't wait where the oasis can be found. Turn to chapter 3 and we'll briefly look at it as we finish. You see, life under this sun isn't so bad, is it, really? Sometimes. We can get as far as the professor gets several times looking at life under the sun. End of chapter 2, verse 24. There's nothing better for a man than that he should eat and drink and find enjoyment in his toil. This, I saw, is from the hand of God. I mean, God gives everyone food and drink, at least most people, and in a measure of enjoyment in their work, at least. But where's the oasis in the desert? Verse 10 of chapter 3. I have seen the business that God has given to the sons of men to be busy with. He's made everything beautiful in its time. Now we've reached the water in the oasis. Also, he has put eternity into man's mind. Yet so that he cannot find out what God has done from the beginning to the end. Verse 14, I know that whatever God does endures forever. Nothing can be added to it, nor anything taken from it. God has made it so, in order that men should fear before him. Everything God does lasts, it's permanent. And God has put into our hearts a longing for that which is permanent, for eternal security, which no more Gulf crisis, no more IRA bombs, no more personal tragedies and breakups can spoil. The solution to vanity is eternity. The solution to the pointlessness of life on this earth is the purpose of God for the next earth, the new heaven and the new earth. And what injects meaning into this life, life in this world, is the perspective of the God who made the world and will one day wind it up and judge all its inhabitants. Which is why, verse 14, the fear of God is the only proper response to God. Yes, the world may have lost its direction and stability, and God alone can restore it. And in Jesus Christ, God has come down from above the sun, down to our world under the sun. And he's come to remedy man's unrighteousness, to answer his cry for security and love. And by his death on the cross in the place of the unrighteous, permanent meaning can be found in this otherwise meaningless life Yes, it was God who let the world go into this state of meaninglessness. But he has subjected it to that because he has placed within it hope through Jesus Christ and his death and resurrection for a world to come of which we get just a taste under the sun. Let's bow our heads. I consider that the sufferings of this present time are not worth comparing with the glory that is to be revealed to us. For the creation waits with eager longing for the revelation of the sons and daughters of God. For the creation was subjected to meaninglessness, not of its own will, but by the will of him who subjected it in hope of liberation. Our great God in heaven, we thank you that you sent your Son, our Lord Jesus Christ, down to earth, that he might rescue us from the meaninglessness of life under the sun, and that we now have solid certainty and hope if we trust in him forever. Amen.